British fishing vessels may have reached Newfoundland as early as the 1480s, and areas to the south soon after. In 1501, just 9 years after Columbus's first voyage, the Portuguese adventurer Gaspar Corte Real abducted 50-odd Indians from Maine. Examining the captives, Corte Real found to his astonishment that two were wearing items from Venice, a broken sword and two silver rings. As James Axtell has noted, Corte Real probably was able to kidnap such a large number of people only because the Indians were already so comfortable dealing with Europeans that big groups willingly came aboard his ship. The earliest written description of the people of the First Light was by Giovanni da Verrazzano, an Italian mariner for hire, commissioned by the King of France in 1523 to discover whether one could reach Asia by rounding the Americas to the north. Sailing north from the Carolinas, he observed that the coastline everywhere was densely populated, smoky with Indian bonfires. He could sometimes smell the burning hundreds of miles away. The ship anchored in wide Narragansett Bay, near what is now Providence, Rhode Island. Verrazzano was one of the first Europeans the natives had seen, perhaps even the first, but the Narragansett were not intimidated. Almost instantly, 20 long canoes surrounded the visitors. Cocksure and graceful, the Narragansett sachem leapt aboard, a tall, long-haired man of about 40, with multicolored jewelry dangling about his neck and ears, as beautiful of stature and build as I can possibly describe, Verrazzano wrote. The pilgrims were less sanguine about Indians' multicolored, multi-textured mode of self-presentation. To be sure, the newcomers accepted the practicality of deerskin robes for walking in the woods, as opposed to, say, fitted British suits. And the colonists understood why native skin and hair shone with bear or eagle fat. It warded off sun, wind, and insects. And they could overlook the Indians' practice of letting prepubescent children run about without a stitch on. But the pilgrims, who regarded personal adornment as a species of idolatry, were dismayed by what they saw as the indigenous penchant for foppery. The robes were adorned with animal head mantles, snakeskin belts, and birdwing headdresses. Worse, many Donlanders tattooed their faces, arms, and legs with elaborate geometric patterns and totemic animal symbols. They wore jewelry made of shell and swan's down earrings and chignons spiked with eagle feathers. If that weren't enough, both sexes painted their faces red, white, and black, ending up, Gookin sniffed, with one part of their face of one color and another of another, very deformedly. And the hair! As a rule, young men wore it long on one side in an equine mane, but cropped the other side short, which prevented it from getting tangled in their bowstrings. But sometimes they cut their hair into such wild patterns that attempting to imitate them, Wood sniffed, would torture the wits of a curious barber. Tonsures, pigtails, head completely shaved but for a single forelock, long sides drawn into a queue with a raffish shortcut roach in the middle, all of it was prideful and abhorrent to the pilgrims. Not everyone in England saw it that way. Inspired by asymmetrical Indian coiffures, 17th-century London blades wore long, loose hanks of hair known as lovelocks. As for the Indians, evidence suggests that they tended to view Europeans with disdain as soon as they got to know them. The Huron in Ontario, a chagrined missionary reported, thought the French possessed little intelligence in comparison to themselves. Europeans, Indians told other Indians, were physically weak, sexually untrustworthy, atrociously ugly, and just plain smelly. The British and French, many of whom had not taken a bath in their entire lives, were amazed by the Indian interest in personal cleanliness. The Mi'kmaq in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia scoffed at the notion of European superiority. If Christian civilization was so wonderful, why were its inhabitants all trying to settle somewhere else?